Hello, everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write for thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. And this week we're going to be talking about the classic Martin Scorsese film Mean Streets and the classic Dolph Lundgren film Showdown in Little Tokyo. And we're going to discuss Mean Streets first, but I'd like to say, in doing the research on this movie, I was kind of amazed to find that Showdown in Little Tokyo has a more intricate plot description than the Wikipedia entry on Mean Streets. I was really let down because I was going to try to learn as much as I could about, you know, the mob culture of Little Italy in the early 70s, but Wikipedia really let me down there. Oh, well. Mean Streets was only Martin Scorsese's second movie. It came out in 73. It starred Harvey.
Third movie.
Oh, really? Well, his second movie was Boxcar Bertha for Roger Corman, I understand. What was his movie before that or after that?
Who's That Knocking on My Door from 69 with Harvey Keitel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is that available?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, cool. Yeah, I mean, Harvey Keitel is really young in this, although he still kind of, it's funny. I mean, when the movie starts out, he sort of looks so young that he's not recognizable, but then he's pretty quickly recognizable. And so is Robert De Niro, for whom this was, you know, one of his very early movie roles. I think his first was in Brian De Palma's High Mom from 68 or so. And De Niro's, you know, younger, thinner, but still totally, you know, recognizable, and he's got his persona. And obviously it's a good movie, but two things really leapt out at me. Number one is that Scorsese has been making, he hasn't been making the same movie over and over during his whole career. He's been making like two kinds of movies over and over his whole career. One is the Mean Streets, Goodfellas kind of slice of life, episodic look at interconnected criminals, usually, and then the other is like one loner against the world, like Raging Bull or King of Comedy or Taxi Driver. But Mean Streets has all these trademarks of Scorsese that have been copied by lots of other people, and probably the most obvious one to me is direction by soundtrack. I mean, I don't think there are like barely any scenes in this movie that don't have some kind of musical accompaniment. And most of them are Motown songs, which is something that The Big Chill would get people doing over and over again 10 years later. But in this one it was sort of contemporary. There's even a couple of Rolling Stones songs,
yeah.
And I guess the rights to those were really cheap at the time. But you know, it's like 10, 15 years later or whatever. In Goodfellas, he's, you know, he got Rolling Stones songs, he got Motown songs, and that would sort of be Scorsese's trademark if everybody else hadn't copied it. And unfortunately, I sort of wish he had been the only director who'd been allowed to do that, because throwing well-known or just good songs into the soundtrack of your movie to accompany scenes is a really lazy way of keeping your movie moving along. And if all these songs, and about half the songs are like Motown songs, and about half are Italian songs, and they add a lot. The movie would probably be pretty boring if they weren't all in there, though. But maybe not, because, I mean, all the scenes are staged very slice of life. Scorsese's camera doesn't do a lot of trickery. I mean, you know, this was a relatively low-budget film, but he gets a lot of mileage out of having handheld camera and just kind of moving through stuff. There's lots of scenes where fights break out and the camera starts to jostle around, and that was pretty new at the time, and it still works. But it's such a copied technique now that it's very modern. This is like a very modern feeling movie, I would say, except in that there's no, it's so slice of life. There's the plot doesn't have a real forward thrust. You can sort of guess how it's going to end from the beginning.
Yeah.
You're just sort of watching things play out. In that Harvey Keitel is, he's the nephew of a mobster. He, you know, he's an up and comer in the mafia. Robert De Niro is, Robert De Niro's got debts all over town, and he's kind of crazy. So in the end, he's gonna end up getting it because he's shooting his mouth off, and that's what happens. And Keitel can't look out for him all the time.
One of the things I noted, I forgot about the soundtrack, and that it was in color, because I think that for whatever reason, I always feel like it's in black and white. I don't know why. But because it kind of fits with Raging Bull in some ways, and obviously in some way, I think it, Goodfellas obviously, but American Graffiti was the same year, and it used the popular soundtrack, sort of innovative use of recognizable music, the same kind of, not the same way at all, because in American Graffiti was present all the time, and Scorsese sort of picks and chooses how he's going to use it here. And then, I don't want to forget about it, but speaking of music, did you notice how the last scene sort of mirrored, have you seen The Godfather Part 3?
No.
Okay, so the end of The Godfather Part 3 is like, there's an opera, and there's a shootout, and blah, 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 blah. And I think that Coppola got it from Scorsese's end of Mean Streets. Just the way all that stuff's juxtaposed. And so I just find that amusing because Scorsese sort of, yes, he came up with everybody else, but he was not part of that club, the Lucas, Coppola, Spielberg,
De Palma.
De Palma, Milius Club.
Milius.
Yeah.
Schrader.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very weird club that he. Well, I don't think Schrader would have been more part of the Scorsese club, wouldn't he have?
Well, yeah, sure, since he wrote Taxi Driver.
All right. But, yeah, so you've got all the camera. And did you watch the DVD, or was it?
No, I watched it somewhere.
I don't know how your copy looked, but I watched the new copy from whatever the Scorsese box set from a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember it ever being so vibrant. Like, it's such a clean print, and it just kind of feels weird.
No, my print was pretty clean, too.
Yeah,
and, the colors get pretty vibrant because there's this bar that the characters all hang out at, and there's so it's always, like, red-tinted.
Yeah.
But there is, it's not washed out on the print I saw. It was very crisp.
So that was very kind of different this time because I think I was used to it always being sort of a nasty print.
Like on VHS.
Yeah. So some of the interesting things about it that I think I know I remember them is the movie, maybe more than all of other Scorsese's other movies, has a lot to do about, not a lot to do about it, but there's a lot about race in it in a way
it's sort of there. He doesn't make a point out of it, but I was kind of surprised when, early in the movie, Harvey Keitel notices this black girl who's a dancer at this club, and he's got a little crush on her. And then much later, he asks her out. He says, "Hey, I might be, opening my own place soon. Maybe you could be a hostess there." And then it doesn't really go anywhere. But I really thought it was going to go. You don't even see her again after that. But I really thought it was going to go somewhere when a couple of Harvey Keitel's buddies, Richard Romanus and David Provel, are talking about, one is showing him a picture to the other of his new girl, and this is my new girl, and the other guy says, "Oh yeah, I saw her kissing a nigger under a bridge," and the guy's like, "Oh geez, I've kissed her,"
Yeah, she shows up in the last shot montage, which is kind of weird.
Oh, yeah, even though she's not part of the action.
Even though she's not part of, the primary characters at all, she shows up in the, city going to sleep montage at the end of it. And, so this is his first movie in New York. Well, no, I think, was filmed on location in New York.
Yeah.
Was that Knocking on My Door was filmed in New York. But, this one, actually, most of this, they said, is filmed in L.A., like all the bar scenes are filmed in LA, and you know, most of your interiors were filmed in LA, and then, but he has this shot at the end, that shot with the parade, sort of closing off the movie since it opened with the parade, but then with the parade's lit up, and then the only other thing you can really see is the Empire State Building, and it's kind of like this, you know, this is still recognizable New York. You're only that far from Hollywood, New York. It's in the background, and then you've got this block, basically, where this is going on. And you never feel confined, even though they don't really go anywhere during the movie. During the most of the movie, it doesn't feel like they're in a restricted area.
No, it's true. I mean, there's a lot of exterior scenes on location, a lot of walking around on the streets, so that doesn't feel confined. But there's also a lot of scenes... not just in that bar that they hang out with, but you know, other establishments where they go around to collect the protection money, and there's a big fight scene in a pool hall, which is a downstairs business. But even because of that, I think it's probably because of Scorsese's camera work that it doesn't feel confined. Like if it were static shots setting up all these basement businesses, it would probably feel a lot more confined than the way the camera kind of lets you walk around the place as if you were in there.
And I mean, the thing is that, yes, this is the movie that sort of launched De Niro, and I don't think Keitel and Scorsese have made a movie. The next movie they made together was Last Temptation, which was 13 years later. So, and you know, Keitel's character Charlie is kind of the stand-in for Scorsese, to the point that Scorsese reads some of Keitel's inner monologue is read by Scorsese. So it's kind of weird that, I always thought it was weird that he went with De Niro, who in this one seems more like a live-action Looney Tunes character until the end.
Right.
And I always thought that was interesting because Keitel's character is so...
He also has top billing in the end credits
over Keitel.
Which is incredible.
But
it's almost like Scorsese knew that De Niro was going to be the bigger star.
Yeah, but I mean, Keitel's character is so weird. So you've got like his whole dating things going on, like the black girl, and then he's sleeping with De Niro's cousin on the side, and he can't tell anybody about it because you know his uncle's a big boss and he's going to get his own place and he can't be seen around this girl and all that kind of thing. But then his hero is Francis of Assisi. I mean, it's just this crazy, to the point that he compares himself to Saint Francis. And I mean, it's this great scene where
and the cousin just laughs at him.
Yeah. And it's just, he's so sort of unaware of reality in a way.
It's almost like he's narrating the movie. It's almost like the whole movie is something that he's remembering one night, the way it opens, especially the way it opens up with Scorsese doing his inner monologue and saying, you know, you don't make up for your sins in church, you make up for them on the streets. And just like the interracial relationship wasn't really developed, they also kind of tease his, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's there. It's not, the movie's so slice of life that it doesn't try to make you think too much about any one thing, but he's very religious and he's got he knows that, you know, the life of a mobster is not a moral one, and he has this thing where he touches flames to remind himself of what the fires of hell must be like, and that's a really great character detail. But it's not like it's not like the movie closes with him bleeding in a pool on the street and in the Christ pose or anything. Like, it's just there. It's just it's a necessary detail.
It's almost like a character. It's like, almost like a weakness that he's unaware of. That he would see it as a personal strength, but of everybody there, he's actually the least successful in a way because he's trying to be so passive.
Someone even says that to him. He says, you know, you think that it's one of your strong suits that you're that you're going to help people. That's not a strong suit. That's a weakness.
Yeah.
Maybe, might have been the cousin.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Which, of course, brings up interesting things about her, because it's not like she's a well-adjusted person. There are no well-adjusted people. The most well-adjusted person in the movies is probably the villain. Michael, played by... What's his name?
Richard...
Richard Romanus, who's the one guy who pretty much went on to nothing of the four. Because the movie's set up at the beginning like a... I mean, it really kind of reminds... Diner is the nice version of Mean Streets. But, I mean, the movie opens with, you know, you go through the names. You've got David... Richard Romanus is... He might even be the first guy you get with the little Michael text on the screen, and then De Niro and Keitel and David Provol is very recognizable because he went on to tons of small roles. But
yeah, and I'd always been looking forward to seeing this one. It was my first time seeing this, by the way.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah,
I'd always been looking forward to seeing this one because of the Ralph Bakshi movie, Hey Good Lookin', which was released in the early 80s but was filmed about 10 years earlier. And the two main characters in that are voiced by Romanus and Provol.
Oh, okay. But yeah, so Romanus is in... And so seeing Mean Streets, and then Scorsese didn't really do another mob movie until Goodfellas, right? Like, I don't think.
No, I don't think so either.
It's kind of strange, and Romanus is more like a character out of Goodfellas than he is like a character like the other guys who are just sort of around. And that's kind of the thing, is that Romanus is going to be the successful one. You can tell that in the very sort of Goodfellas way, Romanus is the future of the neighborhood because he's willing to step up when he has to, whereas... Mm-hmm.
And Keitel has this feeling of responsibility for an obvious Looney Tune.
And then of course there's the, did Keitel cause? They sort of suggest that De Niro's character took a beating by the cops for Keitel, and Keitel kind of jokes that he never recovered from it. But, I mean, in the dialogue, it's clear that they were beating on his head pretty bad, and maybe that's one of the reasons that he's so kind of not doing well.
This movie taught me that, or it reminded me that New York cops in 1973 still dressed like it was the 20s or the 30s. They still have these big button jackets, and their uniforms are not what we think of now. They're much more like uniforms, like old soldier uniforms.
Yeah.
And I love the scene where the fat guy who runs the pool hall pays off the cops, because they've got the routine down pat. Like, you going somewhere? You need traveling fare. The lingo. And this is all stuff that Scorsese supposedly grew up around, and that's how he knew the mob of Lower East Side in Manhattan. So did De Niro, apparently. He also grew up near Little Italy.
Yeah, and on that, didn't we watch something else where we wondered if it was the guy making the movie? Metropolitan. You know?
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's like, is this really not supposed to be 1973, or is it supposed to be a little bit earlier? I mean, they go see The Searchers in the theater.
But they also go to see some color, like Hammer movie or Mario Bava movie.
Yeah.
Too. So that dates it. It's either got to be a Bava or a Hammer movie. But it's some color horror movie that definitely came out in the 60s. Oh, and there's posters for John Cassavetes' husbands and Ray Milland's ex, the man with the X-ray eyes, as well. And Cassavetes and Scorsese were friends, of course. Oh, and a poster for Point Blank with Lee Marvin.
And
so,
yeah.
And it has to be later than 67.
So, the other thing is how gradual it is. I mean, because it really doesn't have a plot. And that was kind of the thing I remembered this time watching it.
It's 2 hours long with very little plot.
Very little plot. It opens with the parade. It closes with a parade. They never tell you what the parades are for.
Oh, it's the Feast of San Gennaro. It's a annual tradition.
But there are two feasts then, right? Because it opens with one, and then about a month later, it ends. And the 4th of July is in there somewhere.
Okay, well, right? Yeah, I don't think a whole year passes.
No, not a whole year, but like a month. It's like a month, because one of the things that continues through the whole movie is how De Niro owes Richard Romanus money. Mm-hmm. That Romanus is like an up-and-coming loan shark, and he owes him money, and he's putting off paying him. And I think the movie only takes place over like 3 weeks. Because you can you can kind of track it over when De Niro was supposed to pay him but didn't, it seemed mm-hmm. like. But it's just how...
Well, I guess the Italians just love a parade. Okay. And they'll look for any excuse.
But the funny thing is they complain about the parade. They talk about how much they hate the parade at one point.
Of course, with all the jump cuts in this movie, maybe it does take place over a year. And that's kind of Scorsese's other directorial trademark that that isn't copied too much, really. But it is Scorsese's trademark, big jump cuts. It's a very European thing. And sometimes he uses that in conjunction with his popular soundtrack trademark. He'll play a few seconds of a popular song, and then it'll do a jump cut into somewhere else entirely.
Right. I'm trying to think of... We always have trouble talking about the good movies. Why can't we... That's not our fault. All right.
Oh, how about that... how about that gay guy that they give a lift to?
Okay, that's another...
Do you think his super faggoty voice was dubbed over? Because it sounds like they brought someone in to do the most mincing Charles Nelson Reilly gay voice that they could.
Well, the gay voice is another... The gay thing is another weird thing. Another strange inclusion to the movie. Because they're not homophobic. He's an annoying little jerk. Mm-hmm. I mean, the gay guy in the front, and the gay guy, they all drink at David Provost's bar. And that's kind of a weird thing, because... I don't know. Just for some reason, that kind of stuck out too. That,
well, it's sort of like, you know, the presence of race and Scorsese knowing how non-Italians were viewed by Italians where he was growing up. Because pretty late in the movie, they, you know, some Jewish girl is at the bar, and one of them makes a remark like, "Yeah, you know, she's a Jewish girl. She's got a different guy here every night of the week. You know how they are." And she's a totally inconsequential character. It's just a detail. Oh, and when they're picking up their debt from the fat pool hall owner, he calls him a mook, and that really that really starts shit up, because I think that's an Italian slur, isn't it?
I don't know. I'm looking it up right now, because...
It's got to be Italian or Irish, but if it were Irish, it wouldn't make any damn sense, unless it was like an insult to be calling an Italian an Irishman.
They're basically, it's not a racial slur in any way. It's just,
Okay. Sounds like
generally generic derogatory term. Mm-hmm. Too widely used to pin down.
Sounds like gook. That's why I was confusing it.
But, they don't. The Jewish girl thing, I think, they also raise the question, because when she's leaving, he throws her the coat. And that's the scene where the only scene in the movie where Keitel is petty is she's there with the guy, and he gets the guy's ass kicked. Mm-hmm. Because it's Keitel's bar, the guy's just in there, and Keitel provokes a fight with him, then stands back and lets all of his friends beat the crap out of the guy and throw him out. And that's the only shallow moment of Keitel, because the rest of the time he's way too concerned with doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what's strange is that the character, I don't think it's not an act. He's sincerely trying to do the right thing, and he has, all the regret of never of failing to do the right thing at times. And that's kind of what made it. Harvey Keitel's like a cute romance. You can see him going on to like some romantic comedy after this. If somehow Mean Streets had been made in the 1980s, Harvey Keitel's next movie would have been, with Julia Roberts or something. He's the perfect, guy for Sandra Bullock in this.
Maybe, because he's got a gruff cuteness. It would be like if Gene Hackman had accepted the role as Mr. Brady on the Brady Bunch instead of doing the French Connection. You just Harvey Keitel could have been a lovable dad or something, or a divorced dad in the midst of a new romance that his daughter is trying to hook him up with.
Yeah. My Two Dads with Harvey Keitel and Robert De Niro. They had to remake that.
Of course, Robert De Niro got to have it both ways. He got to be a serious actor and then a completely unserious actor who'd do anything for a check. Once he got tired of being a real actor.
For the check, man. Have we talked about that? What changed his mind?
I think you've said it was The Fan.
It was around the era of The Fan. I think it was because Jim Carrey was getting so much money per movie that De Niro decided, hey, I'm the greatest living actor. You better pay for it, and then I'll do whatever you want me to do, type thing. But strangely, some of his crazier roles, like Rocky and Bullwinkle, no, he produced that movie. Like, that was like a dream project.
I must have been a big Jay Ward fan.
But,
I wonder if he produced Brendan Fraser's Jay Ward adaptations.
I don't think he did, because I think those were directed by the same guy. Mm-hmm. Those, Hugh Wilson, who did Police Academy, I think. I have a soft spot for George of the Jungle, possibly because of John Cleese's The Gorilla. But, anyway...
Anyway,
back to where were we? This started with me wanting
Robert De Niro.
That was before that. I wanted to point out. Oh, the girl mm-hmm. with the coat. Well, when the girl's leaving after she follows the guy she was there without, not staying with Keitel, he throws her coat, which also happened in the first or second scene in the bar where you can't see the girl. So, I sort of took it to mean that that was the same girl, and it was like just a. This is the standard, this is the regular thing that goes on at the bar type thing. It's hard to explain, but I mean, the movie's filled with these little nuances that... I don't know, I mean, it's very 70s.
Well, it's kind of, there's a lot of little nuances to show how Keitel's character plays off, and like the fact that De Niro's cousin, his girlfriend, has epilepsy.
Yeah.
And Keitel's mob uncle is, totally condescending about that, saying that she's sick in the head. But when she has epilepsy, De Niro, abandons her, and Keitel has to take care of her because De Niro won't take care of his own cousin.
So... When he throws the girl her coat, the second time, he makes some comment about seeing her at church, to which I took to mean that maybe she wasn't Jewish,
Well, she's credited as Jewish girl.
Is she?
So I think she is, yeah.
Okay, because the other two girls at the beginning were supposed to be Jewish, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the ones that De Niro brings into the bar were supposed to be Jewish, too, and they
just said he picked them up at the village.
Yeah, and that's where... Keitel was going to go meet the black girl, was in the village, and so the village is this totally different other place that I don't think we never see it during the day in the movie, so we don't see how Keitel would have seen what was going on there. But what's crazy about that is it's not very far from Little Italy, except it feels like,
right.
It's like right. 7 hours away, and yeah. A lot of other mob movies do that whole thing. Well, the Growing Up in New York movie does the whole thing of talking about how far away and how different a world it is. And Mean Streets kind of shows it by how the audience perceives the perceives the setting, instead of having some character refer to it.
Yeah, well, it's something, you know, something about the way that, like you were saying, this movie could have potentially taken place a few decades earlier. It's sort of because of the old-fashionedness of the Italian culture that Scorsese's depicting, that it feels that way. And when you see those two girls, think about it now, the two girls from the village at the start of the movie that De Niro brings in, they're just so from this other world that they really feel like, you know, they're artistes and, you know, quasi-hippies or just hip girls, you know, from the village, whatever, probably listen to a lot of Rolling Stones. They really do feel like they're from another world, and they're sort of from a more modern world in 1973 than anybody in Keitel's world.
Yeah,
well, they're also giving it a sense of time. There's that guy who came back from Vietnam who they're throwing a party for.
Yeah.
At some point in the bar.
Which is one of the weirder scenes in the movie, in a way,
yeah,
because
he starts a fight, but he's a totally inconsequential character. So there's no reason for that party scene.
And there's no reason for the party scene other than it's supposed to be one of the times that they talk about the money that De Niro owes. But he goes nuts sort of at the end of it. And one of Scorsese's short films that I haven't seen but have read about in sort of the super artsy way, it's called The Big Shave, and it's about a guy who cuts himself shaving.
Yeah, I read about that one too.
That's the huge metaphor for the Vietnam War, apparently.
Mm-hmm, right, he's shaving his skin off, basically.
Yeah, and so I always think of that when I see Mean Streets. And it's maybe the only time that... Well, actually, no, because in Goodfellas, isn't there a Vietnam vet who doesn't have his legs, maybe?
I don't recall.
I can't remember. It's in something, but anyway. Yeah, so it's a weird... And it's one of those big, long scenes in this. And there's that one. There's... I mean, the pool hall scene is a big, long scene, but at least... I mean, not... It has a lot of action, but he's very deliberate and doesn't really worry about being commercial, even though he's got the Rolling Stones on the soundtrack.
Yeah. Oh, and, you know, speaking of how commercial it is, apparently Corman offered him funding if he shot the movie with an all-black cast.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
And it sounds like Corman offered him more money than he got otherwise. So,
yeah. Oh, but he got the money from... The movie was produced by the road manager of the band, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of The Last Waltz fame, which, of course, Scorsese directed the concert movie.
Okay.
Possibly as a favor for funding Mean Streets, but just because he also liked the music.
Now, Scorsese was 35 when this came out? 31-ish when he did this, so... Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, all the... You know, he's the Young Turks of the 70s. He was in there. Totally. Well, I mean, because, you know, you think of... Who is it that I always think of as... I always thought he was young. Danny Boyle was, like, 55 when he made Trainspotting.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just kind of one of those things. And then, we just ran over a little, but last thoughts on Mean Streets.
I like the idea. From now on, sometimes if I'm bored, I'll imagine what Mean Streets would have been like as a blaxploitation movie produced by Roger Corman.
Yeah.
Because all that Italian stuff would have just been thrown out the window when you would have had this plotless plotless slice of life blaxploitation movie. I mean, I can't believe... I mean, it feels like a lot of the dialogue was improvised, and it seems like... you know, I mean, especially with Scorsese's movies, I mean, sometimes people say of making a good movie, like half of it is casting it well, and Scorsese can obviously cast really well. And yeah, if, like, who knows what the screen, how much of the dialogue in the movie was in the screenplay, but it's so plotless, it's kind of hard for me to imagine Corman seeing a commercial potential in it enough to want to make it into a blaxploitation movie.
Yeah.
Or what a Martin Scorsese blaxploitation movie would be, but you know, we know how Italians feel about black people, so that wasn't going to happen. Oh, which is to say, they, you know, Scorsese at least, you know, is all for tolerance, as evidenced by Keitel's crush.
Yeah. Okay. And apologizing. Anyway. And apologizing to the maid.
Oh, speaking of race.
Okay.
Showdown in Little Tokyo was probably titled, I mean, to make it sound like the sequel to Big Trouble in Little China. And like Big Trouble in Little China, it's a racial team-up movie, which is, I mean, Big Trouble was 86, but this was 91, and that was a real turning point for action movies, because it was kind of the transitional year from 80s action movies to 90s action movies. And just like The Last Boy Scout from 91, it's a racial team-up movie. Instead of white Bruce Willis and black Damon Wayans, you got white Dolph Lundgren and Asian Brandon Lee, son of Bruce Lee, star of The Crow. This was his first American movie, apparently. And directed by Mark Lester, who directed two of the most important dumb action movies of the 80s, Schwarzenegger's Commando and Class of 1984. And it, this is I think the best dumb action movie we've watched, because I mean, Lester still clearly had the chops from Commando, because the action pretty much never lets up. And I mean,
well, it is only 75 minutes or something.
Well, yeah, but compare it to The Last Boy Scout, and it's like,
well,
God,
true.
Last,
well, yeah, I mean, this
Last
is...
Boy, Last Boy Scout is like Howard's End compared to how much action is in this, you know. And
it's also the gayest action movie we've watched.
Actually, I don't think it's. I think if it had been made a few years earlier, it would have been gayer if it had been made in the 80s. But because you've got Tia Carrere as the love interest, and the fact that there even is a love interest who doesn't get killed after sleeping with one of the stars.
She gets raped the scene before she sleeps with the star.
Yes, but she gets to live. And if it had been made in the 80s, I think she would have been killed in that scene, especially if it came after sleeping with Dolph Lundgren. I think the fact Tia Carrere lives distinguishes it as a 90s style action movie.
I still think that Brandon Lee's sort of asexually gay on Dolph Lundgren.
That's true. Although he remarks, you know, he makes jokes about how he doesn't eat sushi, but he might if it's off a naked woman, and he might like to culturally immerse himself in Tia Carrere.
Yeah,
once
I
he
like
sees
that,
her.
That line.
But
about,
he, yeah,
the line about eating the sushi off the naked woman. It's not, oh my God, that's so sexist and disgusting. It's, that's cool, we got to go back there.
Yeah, well, you
which
know,
I
Japanese,
think, you know,
Japanese
that,
culture was getting pretty hip in 91.
Really?
Because we assumed they were going to be our economic masters.
Except
they're
all bad.
Mentality.
They're terrible, terrible people. After I get done watching this, I'm like, you know, it's this and Rising Sun. Japanese people in the early 90s, this is how Mexicans are portrayed now. That they're just like, you know, savages who will kill and maim everyone, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, sell drugs to school children. And it's just like, I know, I mean, this came up because, you know, they do this a lot on TV with the Mexican criminals. It's like, is there no Mexican-American Anti-Defamation League that gets upset about this? Because I know there was a Japanese-American Anti-Defamation League who did get upset about this kind of thing, and that actually affected how...
They got upset about the Big Trouble in Little China, which is extremely pro-Asian, and portrays the white guy as the dumb guy.
So, and then this one is, you know, it's... We haven't synopsized it yet, but it's Dolph Lundgren grew up in Japan. What's his dad doing there?
His dad was an officer in the army or something.
Okay. So Dolph Lundgren's outfits in this movie are like pajama pants and no shirt a lot, and it's a very interesting outfit.
Brandon Lee comments on his upper body and how it doesn't make him as mobile as he could be.
Which if you notice the fight scenes with Dolph Lundgren and Stallone, when he was promoting, I think, Rocky 5, 6, did all those Ain't It Cool News interviews, and he was talking about how when he was making Rocky 4, he got punched in the chest during shooting by Lundgren, and it, like, collapsed his chest. And they took him into the hospital, and the doctor was like, "What'd you do?" He's like, "Well, I was shooting this movie, and Dolph Lundgren punched me." And the guy's like, "Nobody punched you. You got hit by a truck." And so Stallone's like, "Yeah, so you don't want to get hit by Dolph Lundgren." And so every time he's throwing somebody, I believe it now, like, that he's, like, able to throw these guys huge distances and everything. But he's really slow doing it, so I don't really believe that he could do it. He could beat them because he's just so slow. Versus Brandon Lee, who's really fast and jumps up and down and does backflips.
Hey, it's Bruce Lee's kid. Come on. He had to have inherited some of that. Of course, and I like how Brandon Lee along with Tia Carrere, Brandon Lee is basically the only good Asian, and that's because he grew up in America.
And he wants to work in, where does he want to
Malibu.
Work? Malibu. And that's like the best line in the whole movie that you can't work there. Sheriff's Department. And it's just like, wow, they know that? Like, I can't believe they knew that.
Yeah. You know, their banter is, you know, not bad. I mean, hell, it's more organic than Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis. But Brandon Lee is clearly the more charismatic actor. And he also gets off the dumb lines better. He kind of sells them where Lundgren just walks through them.
Well, that's because Lundgren can't emote. I mean,
that's the main problem.
I mean, Lundgren, you know, never has been able to emote. And I actually, you know, like, I like the first Punisher, like, things about the first Punisher movie and other stuff. But, Lundgren's incapable.
That's got evil Japanese ninjas, too. Lundgren must have really had something against Asian people.
That's true. And, of course, RoboCop 3 had evil Japanese.
Yeah, and that was filmed in 91, but not released until 93.
How they didn't get Brandon Lee to be the evil Japanese guy, I mean, that would have been pretty cool, but whatever, because he obviously didn't have a problem playing Japanese.
Speaking of RoboCop, RoboCop 2 had the same DP as Showdown Little Tokyo.
It did?
Yeah, Mark Irwin, who also shot like all of Cronenberg's best movies of the 80s.
And now he shoots the Scary Movie... movies. Wow. It looks like he worked with Lester at least one more time after this. But yeah. That's like the funny thing about it is that it's a 70 some minute. I mean, Warner Brothers produced it. I mean, that's what we said. I don't know if we said it on when we were talking about it last week, but this came out in the theater. I mean, I figured it didn't. I figured it was like I Come in Peace that came out in two theaters and then everybody saw it on pay cable or something. Now, this came out in the theater.
Like, yeah, it didn't
20
do,
of them
do very well.
Or something. But, you know, this is still this weird era, or 140 theaters. And this is, like, still the era of, you know, it's like, I love looking through a newspaper.
It's when Golden Globus type movies were still coming out in the theater.
Well, yeah, but this is Warner Brothers putting out this kind of thing in the theater, and I mean, Warner Brothers wouldn't even produce something like this anymore because, they wouldn't even do it direct to video. Warner Brothers' direct to video arm only does really interconnected, like, you know, prequels to Dukes of Hazzard or properties or something. So I mean, this is just like kind of This is, yeah.
Yeah,
it's well, weird, you know, it was, in a way, but I mean,
at least you know they got to make it on location in LA's actual little Tokyo. They didn't shoot in Canada. I don't know if they would have in '91, but they would today.
And so,
and Little Tokyo is geographically not a very big place, so there's basically like three exterior shots that they keep using over and over.
Is the showdown itself in Little Tokyo? Because they go out of Little Tokyo at one point.
Yeah.
Because the mastermind criminal here, and this is like, I mean, he's played by the guy who's in Mortal Kombat, so he went on to big things. But their plan is they're going to put this new drug called, what was it called? Ice?
Ice, yes.
They're going to put ice in beer bottles and ship it around the country.
Yeah,
but somehow, it doesn't seem as stupid as I just said in the movie. And, I mean, you got to realize he's making this presentation to the black gangs who look like...
It's like the scene in Dark Knight where all the interracial criminal elements of our pure white city are gathered together to confer.
Yeah, and then the black guys are dressed kind of like Flava Flav.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
well, actually, so are the Asian guys. But I mean, even like the Japanese, the Black Claw Yakuza gang, who are the bad guys in this movie. I love how they've got these like zoot suit looking, you know, day glow colored clothing from the early '90s. It's awesome. They look like they're about to go play basketball with Wesley Snipes or something.
But then they have the What are the skinheads, except they're bikers, so whatever. They have hair on their heads, and they cut off his arm at one point.
That's so awesome.
It is, and it's just kind of like, you know, wow, that's better than making a pen disappear, but whatever.
yeah, and Carrie Hiroyuki Tagawa gets off a better line than Heath Ledger too. He says, because now you've only got one hand to wipe your ass with.
So,
I was like, yeah, that's Mark Lester right there.
So
severed limbs.
Unfortunately.
Oh, there's a decapitation also earlier in the film.
Yeah, the pervy, evil Japanese decapitation. Let's not forget, you know.
Yeah, Tagawa is macking on this girl. Party girl at his mansion, and then he decapitates her. And
in
later
front of
raping,
all of his guys.
And then later when he's raping Tia Carrere, he shows her a video of it.
There's some implication, though, that he's impotent.
Yeah, definitely. Or that he can only get it up by watching his own snuff videos.
Yeah.
Also, apparently, there was some extra seconds of that girl's head hitting the floor or something that had to be cut to get an R rating. So,
it is a pretty, it's a pretty solid decapitation in a mainstream-ish action movie.
Yeah,
because I mean,
showing you enough to get the idea.
If we're, I can't believe
the violence in the movie isn't really creative, but there are a lot of squibs, which is important, and it's something that '80s action movies had that '90s action movies started doing away with. Is just lots of guys getting squibs shot in their chest and then flailing their arms around and firing their guns in the air as they drop down.
Yeah.
There's an excellent the titular showdown in Little Tokyo at the very end of the movie is awesome. Because Brandon Lee and Dolph Lundgren are tied up to this torture machine. Asians love torture, and they're getting electrocuted, and then Dolph Lundgren just like, what is he like pushes the torturer into Brandon Lee's torture.
They're getting electrocuted by this guy, and
they're just on a couple like metal boards basically.
Yeah, the metal boards are electrocuting them, and somehow Lundgren pushes the guy's face into
he pushes it into Brandon Lee's board, and that like
That electrocutes him, yeah.
It fatally electrocutes him, but doesn't hurt Brandon Lee. So, whatever.
And then, the weird part about that scene is all the bad guys were there to watch them get tortured, and then they leave for the main bad guy to watch them get tortured on his video, in-car video system.
Mm-hmm.
So when he finds out, he watches them
escape, and oh, damn it, I should have stayed there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. I mean, there's some creative villainy from this villain. He likes to crush guys in a car compactor in a junkyard.
Yep.
Which is where the two get tortured. And there's a really obvious dummy in a car the first time that happens. And what else? The showdown is great because like it ends up on the streets of Little Tokyo and there's another parade going on and they've got those like what Glover and Gremlins 2 described as those dragon things, which I don't even know if there's a Japanese or not, but Dolph Lundgren challenges him to a sword duel and they do it and he's avenging the death of his parents and he like slices him into a spinning wheel of fireworks and he gets stuck on it and starts spinning around and the fireworks engulf him in flames. And instead of being horrified, all the Japanese revelers in the streets bow to him, just like the Japanese guy at the end of RoboCop 3 bows to RoboCop. So if you ever do anything really cool around Japanese people, especially if you kill someone in a creative way, they will bow. They will acknowledge how badass you are instead of, running, screaming in terror. And I also liked how he does this after, pretty early on in the movie, Brandon Lee says, "You're a loose cannon. We're going to do this by the book. We're going to bring him in." And then, the second half of the movie, they have no regard for their status as police officers whatsoever.
Do you even shoot guys see their boss?
No, that's the thing. There's no angry police chief or anything, which is a little disappointing.
Because as I'm watching it, I'm like, they've got to have a black boss. It'd be perfect if they had a black boss.
Yeah, no, there's no Sergeant Reed or anything.
No, and then there's like this coroner lady who's only in one scene, even though there's no investigation here. I mean, that's kind of the thing about it, is that the movie starts once they run into this. This guy, the bad guy, it's not like he doesn't know that he killed his parents. He knows right away, and he pulls a gun on him. And, just kind of,
And then they back out, and then we're going to do it by the book, and then they don't do it by the book.
But
and it
they've
doesn't
been,
matter.
Let's see. So they're in this huge fight scene in the nightclub, where you would think as they enter the nightclub, somebody makes a remark about how they know Lundgren and they know he's the big blonde cop in Little Tokyo. And so then they drag them all down to the bad guy's basement office at gunpoint. And they know they're cops. So I'm not sure why they get to leave later. Like, a few minutes later, when they're like, "We're cops, we're going to leave."
Well, he says, people saw us come in, and you don't want people to know that two cops disappeared in here. But it's pretty hokey, I agree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there isn't even the attempt at making this a legitimate police movie. I mean, these guys are as cartoony of cops as...
Yeah, and that's Mark Lester. That's Mark Lester's awesome stream of consciousness style of direction. Because Class of 1984 is just like that, too. You got this teacher who's being terrorized by these punk students who grow increasingly violent, and, the law is just not an issue. It takes place in a magical world without police intervention, or you got to take the law in your own hands, even if you are a cop. There aren't any other cops. You're the only cops in the world.
Well, they run from the cops at some point.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's after they have a fight fight in a bathhouse with the bad guys gang.
Yeah, where they get their butts kicked, which doesn't make any sense to me. That scene, I'm like, while they're creeping up behind them, you don't notice them doing that. Like, it's.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Dolph Lundgren is good. He's stealthy. He was trained in ninjutsu, and you never hear him coming, which leads to a really funny line from Tia Carrere after they have sex, which
I guess
people should see the movie because it kind of has to be seen to believe. And by the way, that's the sex scene that happens after she gets raped. So it's good to know that, you know, having sex with Dolph Lundgren is the same as going to a rape crisis center. And
she's
going to
kill herself because of the rape, but Dolph Lundgren, he saved her. Not only did first he saves her, right? She's going to kill herself. And I think they say it's by seppuku. Isn't seppuku the one where you need two people?
No, I think seppuku is self-inflicted.
That's self-inflicted? What's the one where you need two people?
I don't know the name for that.
I believe there's one where you need two people. Anyway, so she was going to kill herself. And it's never clear until that point that she was really into being culturally Japanese, because she...
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, then Dolph Lundgren saves her, to his homemade Japanese house, which I felt really bad that they don't show him rebuilding it at the end, with her, like, there making him iced tea and Brandon Lee showing up telling a joke. But anyway, so then they're there, and has she had a chance to shower since being raped? Probably, right? But
well,
maybe not.
She gets naked when she's there, or her body double gets
her
naked.
Her body
anyway.
Double takes a bath with Dolph Lundgren. One of the worst body doubles, you know, you can think of. Totally different hair, whatever. I mean, it's just shockingly bad body double. Gets naked with Dolph. I guess that's a bath. That they take a bath together. But she's not very traumatized from the moment Dolph Lundgren saves her to them in bed by this rape. And there's some comment that he makes to the bad guy that he can't get it up, that I sort of took that she told him that, like, in confidence, that, you know, even though she'd been disgraced,
couldn't
get it up. So maybe that's why it was, you know, instead of calling it counseling, Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah. Oh, and also performed. speaking of Cox, that's when Brandon Lee tells him that he's got the biggest dick he's ever seen on a man. And Lundgren goes, on a man. So that's as gay as it gets. But that's, you know, Brandon Lee kind of sells the gayness more than any lines of dialogue. That's the one really gay line of dialogue that suggests a possible romance between the two of them. But damn it, Tia Carrere got in the way between them. Just like Bruce Willis's wife was allowed to live and get between him and Damon Wayans.
I think some of the gayness comes from the fact that Brandon Lee has all these, like, one-liners that are really awkwardly done and shot. Like, the camera lingers on him after the one-liner's done instead of going to the reaction shot.
Yeah.
And so instead of it being like some funny one-liner about Dolph Lundgren's upper body, it's instead, you know, this one-liner about his upper body that turns into, his upper body. And you're like, okay. But, and something about their partnership is
pretty early on, I think right after the upper body thing, or it's after Lee has just realized that Lundgren's got a personal vendetta against the bad guy. He says, great, I'm partnered with a homicidal maniac. You know, this is just great. And then he gets out of the car and he's all pissed off and he's like, look, pal, might be stupid, but I like you and that's why I'm going to stick it out.
Yeah, that.
I'm going to stick it out with you for your own good. I'm going to look out for you, pal.
And they've known each other at this point, you know, 4 hours. Because when they meet at the beginning, it's a really funny kind of scene, kind of out of Johnny Dangerously, where Dolph Lundgren's in the... And I can't believe he didn't kill any of those guys in the cafe, in the restaurant fight at the beginning. He's in, you know, a mom-and-pop restaurant, Japanese restaurant.
With the one nice Japanese person in the whole movie that
that isn't
this kindly old lady who runs the place and chit chats with him.
Yeah, and so he gets into a fight with the bad guys, who he's mm-hmm. just seen, let's not forget, shoot up a bar in the first scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's very cautious about how he approaches them. He doesn't, you know, call for backup or even go up to them with his gun drawn, I don't think. And what really pissed me off about that was, do you remember the one, he's the guy who threatens the old lady. He's got the really punky hair.
Mm-hmm.
That guy doesn't have a good death scene, and I really didn't like that guy. I really think they could have done it. I've been waiting for his death scene since that scene. So Lundgren gets in a fight with him, and then throws a guy out the window. Brandon Lee coming down the street sees it, goes in and intervenes. They get into this stupid, you know, fight scene where the bad guys escape, and then you find out they were meeting because he was assigned there.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon Lee had been assigned there, and it just seemed like this just kind of goofy, you know, I can't believe I'm seeing this in a theatrical movie kind of scene. It seemed like really, Police Academy, I think, went for more
procedural
accuracy than this one does.
I also liked how the old lady wasn't at all upset about her store being completely wrecked.
Well, no, Dolph Lundgren wrecked it. That's okay.
It's okay if a friend wrecks your place. It's like if you have a party. You know which goon, which principal goon, let's say, did get a cool novelty death was, what is his name here? Toshiro Obata, who was also in the Ninja Turtles movies, which I remember from my youth. He's like Shredder. He's Shredder's number two right hand man.
Okay,
like
that's why he looked familiar. Yeah.
So he's the right hand man in this too, and he gets just like in RoboCop. Here we go again. Brandon Lee is kicking the shit out of him at the junkyard factory at the end, and he's reading him his rights as he's doing this, and then he kicks him into a vat of, you know, I don't know, it's not toxic waste, it's not that close to RoboCop, but he kicks him in a vat of something that's going to kill him, that's going to melt him or something, and then he tells him he has the right to remain dead.
Yes.
That was awesome. Yeah, they don't make him like this anymore. Just stupid awesome. I had a lot of fun watching this one.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was my thing, is this movie's made for, like, 13-year-old boys.
Exactly.
It's made for 13, and action movies now are not made for 13-year-old boys because they can't afford to buy the DVD, so you have to make it for, I don't know, what, a 17-year-old boy who's got a lot different sensibilities about what's amusing. And it cuts down on the cartooniness by the time you're 17.
Yeah, it's more sarcastic and stuff.
Yeah.
Although I think that's probably what people... I haven't seen them, but I think that's what people seem to appreciate about movies like Crank, because they bring back the stupidity in a way.
Yeah. I've seen some of Crank, and unfortunately, there's a pretense to it. I think that... I'd agree with that, like with something like Taken. What is it? Mm-hmm. The Luc Besson's sort of English language, super dumb, 92-minute action movies type things. So I think that they try to, but even they are way too, you know, they're shot in Panavision. They worry about who's on the soundtrack.
Uh-huh,
you know,
yeah.
They worry it's not the same thing. You really can't.
It's not like when Warner Bros. Would just give Mark Lester a few bucks to make something like this.
Right. Yeah. It's
someone
not...
like someone like Mark Lester, who, you know, had an exploitation background. He was directing B movies all the way back to the 70s.
Yeah.
He directed a really strange comedy called White House Madness, which has Al Grandpa Lewis in it in a small role. But it's a satire of Nixon, and it's like basically a series of blackout sketches with Nixon being all being all Nixon-y, and it's not funny at all, but it's an amazing time capsule of what lowbrow political satire was back in the day.
Well, let's not forget he also directed, speaking of comedy, he directed Armed and Dangerous.
Yeah.
With
Carpenter almost directed that. Actually, he was offered it.
I think I might have seen this in the theater as a kid.
With Eugene Levy and John Candy.
Yeah, yeah. And Meg Ryan, an early Meg Ryan. But yeah, no, Lester sort of... Well, he also directed Firestarter, which Carpenter was supposed to direct, right? From a script by Bill Lancaster, no less. Mm. Which, it's... I don't know why that never happened. Bill Lancaster wrote The Thing and nothing else ever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, and speaking of Lester's body of work, he has a directorial trademark in having his action stars lift up entire cars, which Schwarzenegger does with Ray Don Chong and her little Miata convertible, and in when Lundgren is rescuing Tia Carrere in this, he lifts up an entire car to use as a shield from gunfire.
That's just him hulking out a little, you know. It's mm-hmm. that like that thing where you people have weird powers. That's just all it was.
Yeah.
I don't know. He does have a lot of upper body strength. So
that's right. That's right. Brandon Lee wouldn't have been able to do that.
Not at all. Brandon Lee would have been able to kick it up, though, I bet.
Mm-hmm. So, and if it were Jean-Claude Van Damme, he would have been able to do the splits, but...
Yeah.
Anyways, this is about... Yeah. Does that about do it?
That about does it. I was actually...
For Big Showdown in Little China?
We haven't talked about the connections between the two movies, which is always the, you know, the randomly chosen movies having these strange connections, such as Little Tokyo, Little Italy.
Oh, yeah.
And don't forget the parades.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. All right.
And, hey, the nightclub in... Little Tokyo had a lot of blue light, red light in the other one. Yeah.
You can stop now. That's
okay.
Really, the parades is quite clever enough.
Okay.
Noticing that. I commend you.
But,
so.
Yeah, and yeah. Next week.
Next
we
week.
Are...
We've got for our good movie, the 1942 film noir, co-starring the lovely Veronica Lake of Sullivan's Travels fame, This Gun for Hire. And our bad movie will be the movie that was supposed to be the next Jurassic Park, because it was the first Michael Crichton movie after Jurassic Park, Congo. And I never saw this one, but I've always meant to, because any movie with both Ernie Hudson, Tim Curry, and Bruce Campbell has got to be worth checking out.
And let's not forget, this was supposed to be Bruce Campbell's big breakthrough to the mainstream.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was. It was a big deal that he was in this. It was going to be, you know...
Yeah, right, because Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. had been canceled already, right?
Maybe it was still at the point where they thought they might renew it. I don't know. Can't remember. Yeah. What year was that, 93 or 94?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Congo. With Laura Linney, who has gone on to... she hasn't won an Oscar, but she's actually respected as an actress. And Dylan Walsh, who... you know, so, basically, the two leads are kind of indie people, and then everybody else is... character, recognizable character actors, and then there are really bad gorilla outfits, super gorilla outfits, and bad sets. So maybe everybody should watch Congo with us, because darn, it's a good time. But yeah, that's right. Next week.
Can't wait. Okay. So this has been an Alan Smithy podcast. I've been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
And thanks for listening. See you next time.